So I'm really happy to be talking. I guess this is the condensed matter group. I know all the string theorists here, but not the condensed matter people. And I think it's probably Rob's fault that I'm giving you a talk. So if you get angry, turn around and get angry at him, not at me. But I'm going to talk about some work I've been doing with the group at Stanford. Largely what I'll tell you is based on work in progress and one paper that we wrote with Sri Raghu, who's actually a card-carrying condensed matter physicist and lives in the McCullough building at Stanford. And then two excellent postdocs at Stanford, one of whom is now junior faculty at Johns Hopkins, Liam Fitzpatrick and Jared Kaplan. I'm not going to have a lot of references in my talk, but there are a lot of important references on the kind of system I'm studying. I'll be trying to study non-Fermi liquid states of matter of the sort that appear in this kind of phase diagram when a Fermi liquid interacts maybe with a gapless boson. And there is a long history of literature on this subject. A few of the important references for me, though we'll do some things different from them, are the papers here. And one of the members of your group, Sung-Sik Lee, who's not here today but who's already suffered through this talk more than twice, has really done very interesting work in this area. Okay, so as you all know, the Fermi liquid fixed point is, in the language of the RG, a stable infrared fixed point modulo the BCS instability that leads to superconductivity. It was developed in a sort of modern language by Shankar and Polchinski in the RG framework. And so their starting point is just the free fermion action. Here it is, psi dagger dt psi. There's some Fermi surface with a Fermi energy EF. And here's a picture of the Fermi surface. So roughly there's some dividing line in momentum space. States outside are unoccupied. States inside are filled. And then the low energy degrees of freedom, instead of living at the origin in momentum space, as they do for particle physicists, they actually live on the surface. So the low energy excitations are you can excite an electron above the Fermi surface, or you can create a hole beneath the Fermi surface. Now, the scaling that governs this fixed point is just determined then by this free action. We scale so that the kinetic terms remain invariant. Okay, and so what you should do is you should divide up momenta into the momentum of the point on the Fermi surface closest to the state you're interested in, and then a transverse momentum L to the Fermi surface. Okay, and then expanding the energy, if you have a normal quadratic dispersion, you actually get a linear term in the Taylor expansion that goes like L times a Fermi velocity, where L is that transverse momentum to the Fermi surface. And the scaling you should do then is a little bit unconventional for people used to relativistic field theory. Of course, time scales like the inverse of energy. So if S is scaling the energy, time scales like S inverse. But in the momentum space, what happens is that L scales, but K does not. Okay? So in other words, instead of scaling momenta to the origin, you're scaling momenta to the Fermi surface, where states reach zero energy. Okay. So if we now examine this action with these definitions of how we're scaling time and momenta, we see that we should assign the Fermi field itself dimension a half. Okay, and then the action is invariant. Now, there are various interactions you should then consider to decide whether this fixed point is a reasonable thing or not. Of course, there's one relevant perturbation, which is just shifting around the shape of the Fermi surface. We're shifting the chemical potential, but that's fine. God gave us some value of the chemical potential. We don't care that it's some special value, so we'll assume that it is set to whatever it is, and we won't worry about it. Yeah?
How do we handle the curvature? Because, you know, it could be unimportant on a Fermi surface and kind of go.
So I'll talk about exactly what we're doing as we go on. But I'll actually keep, well, when I get to the problem of interest, I'll actually keep boson momenta that are both parallel and perpendicular to the surface. In this way of writing things, though, I should emphasize nothing has happened to the curvature. Okay, without loss of generality, if you take a circle and work in radial coordinates, you can always choose to measure momenta transverse to the circle. It's not that you've ignored an x or y component of the momentum. You're keeping the full energy. Okay, so it's not that, for instance, one is neglecting ky and keeping kx or something like that. By working in radial coordinates, you really do keep the full energy. If you expand it out in Cartesian coordinates, you see the curvature. Was that your question? Okay. So then, modulo mu, the first interaction that would determine the instability of this fixed point is a kind of four Fermi interaction. Here it is written out. You have particles and holes with momenta that are constrained by a delta function. And if you just then go through the scaling that I wrote down for the momenta and for the field, you'll find that this naively scales like a power of S. So as you go to low energies, you're scaling E to S times E. This operator would look irrelevant. Now, it's a famous story that actually for special kinematic configurations, that's incorrect. What happens for special kinematic configurations, for instance, fermions at antipodal points, is that the delta function scales anomalously, because it's not being constrained in the way that you would guess for generic momenta. And so you actually get marginal interactions for two different kinematic configurations, for BCS couplings and for forward scattering. And so that's how the Landau parameters are captured in this field theory language. But that's about it, okay? So this has, this fixed point has no other interesting perturbations. We already know what the four fermion perturbations do, okay? They're either Landau parameters or they cause superconductivity. And so this action is seemingly not a good starting point to describe non-Fermi liquid physics. Now, you all know more about real systems than I do, okay? I think I've literally never been in a condensed matter lab. But here are some pictures. Because I work with Sri, he likes to have pictures of these elements. So I guess these are, is this called LASCO? It's some kind of cuprate. This is some kind of heavy fermion material. And they're famous phase diagrams, wherein the cuprates as a function of doping, or in these heavy fermions as a function of B or pressure, you can sometimes reach what looks like a quantum critical point. In this picture here, which is very clean, the orange region is a region where you have linear resistivity. So this little fan has linear resistivity, while the blue regions have the more conventional T squared Fermi liquid theory. Okay, so the idea is probably at this point what's happening is there's an interesting phase transition governed by a gapless order parameter field, and it interacts with the Fermi liquid and does something terrible to it. Okay, so I think because these things happen in real interesting systems, I've been told by my colleagues in condensed matter at Stanford that the theoretical description of this kind of non-Fermi liquid behavior is a subject of active interest. And what's good for me is it also seems like a subject related to quantum field theory. And so even with relatively little knowledge of what the little dots in this picture really mean, I can try to attack it using long wavelength descriptions. So as a high energy theorist, what I'm going to do is borrow a lesson from our study of QCD. Okay. So in QCD, you all know, the story is that there's an effective coupling. It starts out weak. The theory is asymptotically free. But it runs strong as you go to long wavelengths. And then all kinds of interesting things happen in the long wavelength limit. You get chiral symmetry breaking. You get confinement of quarks. All of these are beautiful and important facts. And I think it's fair to say, as summarized by the existence of this Clay Millennium problem, this is $1 million that still hasn't been given out yet, that the brute force understanding of QCD remains an open problem. Nobody can prove that there's a mass gap, at least to the satisfaction of mathematicians. But I think it's also true that through use of our freedom as theorists to imagine slightly different worlds, we can use large N methods parametrized by some number of gauge colors and number of flavors of quarks instead of just the few that nature gave us. And here's some pictures that came out of large N methods in ADS-CFT describing QCD on D-brains. Rob is an expert on this thing. We can study supersymmetric toy models, which even at small n, but parametrized by NC and NF, are remarkably tractable now because of supersymmetry. Okay? And because of the use of these extra parameters, imaginary parameters compared to real-world QCD, we've actually come over the last 20 years to understand a really rich set of possible behaviors of non-abelian gauge theory. Okay? Instead of just what we see in the world, we've seen that there are strongly coupled theories with free magnetic duals. We've seen examples of theories that confine like QCD but without breaking chiral symmetry. We've found examples of QCD-like theories that are actually non-trivial interacting conformal field theories in the infrared, like the simplest examples being perturbative, the Banach-Zach fixed points. Okay, and this whole zoo of behaviors is, I think, very educational and informs our knowledge of field theory much more than just brute force understanding of QCD would do. And of course, we also have found some phases that look qualitatively similar to QCD, though, like I said, the $1 million is still there if you want it. Okay, and a point.
More yeah. About this, the three possibilities. So this is a free magnetic field.
Yeah.
This means you have some kind of a well-defined quasi particle.
Yeah, a good example is in real-world QCD. In a certain sense, the low-energy theory is the theory of pions. Okay, because of the explicit breaking of chiral symmetry by quark masses, the pions aren't quite massless. But roughly, there's a sense in which the free pion description of the infrared degrees of freedom is like a free magnetic dual for the infrared of QCD.
So those quasi particles are bosonic, basically.
In QCD, they are, yes.
But when you say magnetic dual, it really means the appearance of bosonic massless particle.
In many of the cases, these are, like in the best understood cases, there are literally gapless excitations.
But are they orthogonal, or are they always appear with a symmetry breaking, or there's something, even without symmetry breaking, you have
there are examples that don't have Goldstone modes. That is where there are gapless degrees of freedom that aren't Goldstone modes.
I see, also free.
But free, I mean, that's because of how I specify this. There are also examples where there's an electric theory and magnetic theory, they're dual, and both flow to a non-trivial fixed point. Okay, then you're just making a statement about universality of RG flow, but it's a surprising statement because the two UV descriptions look quite different. Okay, but this is somehow more similar to QCD because in QCD you have the pion Lagrangian. Okay. Something interesting about QCD, in addition to what we just discussed, is that the high energy fixed point is unstable. Okay, it doesn't govern physics at arbitrarily low energy, but it actually does govern a wide range of energy scales in the phase diagram, and it's been very useful for us to understand energies above the confinement transition using that perturbative fixed point. So I'll take two lessons from the study of QCD. One is it might be fun to take models of non-Fermi liquid, but really vary the full set of parameters that we have at our imagination's disposal and see what kinds of phases we find, instead of focusing on precisely one or two models that people have studied before. And the other is, it might be useful to study even asymptotic high energy fixed points, as long as they can govern physics over some wide range of energy scales in our description, without always worrying about exactly what happens in the deep infrared. Okay, so those will be two themes. So now I'm going to describe our basic setup and then take a little detour and describe relations to other work in other contexts. So we're doing the dumbest possible thing. This is the Lagrangian again that was studied by Shankar and Polchinski and many others. It's just the Lagrangian of the free Fermi liquid. We're going to add to it the simplest thing you could think of at a phase transition, the single gapless order parameter field, whose mass is tuned roughly to zero at the critical point. Okay, so here's a free boson, has some velocity c, and we're going to consider adding the one interaction that around four dimensions could be important, which is the phi to the fourth interaction. Okay, and then we're going to couple the two together perturbatively in the most obvious way you could. We're going to add a Yukawa coupling function. There's some momentum conserving Yukawa coupling like this. And we'll study what the boson and the fermion do to each other in perturbation theory. Okay, so this is all what I just said. We're just adding a boson.
Isn't there also a psi squared term, which, although irrelevant, since it's at lower dimensions, or dimension 6, psi to the fourth?
Say again?
You also have a dimension 5 operator, which is...
No, you're correct. If I kept psi to the fourth, I could really also keep phi squared, psi squared.
Right.
I'm actually, for most of this talk, not going to keep this, and there will be a transparency about that later. This does have all kinds of important effects, and I'll explain why I'm not really going to focus on it later on. Was that your question? So we're going to do the dumbest possible thing. We're going to do perturbative RG in the Yukawa and quartic couplings. And I really mean perturbation theory, meaning I will use the scalings characteristic of the Fermi liquid and the boson. I'm not going to invent some new scaling for this problem. Okay, and I'll introduce three additional control parameters, some of which have obviously been considered by all of you before. One is epsilon. So I'll work in around three spatial dimensions, but a little below. Later, we'll talk about taking epsilon to 1. I'll introduce a matrix of bosons. So there will be an n by n matrix of bosons. Sometimes n is 1, but sometimes it will not be 1 for me. And I'll have nf flavors of fermions transforming as a vector, that is n component fermions. So I'm not gauging anything, but I have an n by n matrix interacting with nf flavors of fermions.
And no gauge field. Just
no gauge field.
Just
yeah. Okay, now I've done one thing here that's a little unconventional for a condensed matter talk. At least I think it is, which is introducing a matrix of bosons. Let me take a little detour now to talk about holography and why I think the matrix of bosons does lead sometimes to interesting results, but then we'll go squarely back to field theory and you can forget about anti-de Sitter space. Okay, so there are some holographic inspirations for considering bosonic large N. And that is that people using ADS-CFT as a means to study large N CFTs doped by a finite density of charge have in recent years found some interesting non-Fermi liquid-like fixed points. Okay, so in general, in the setting of ADS-CFT, the question of finite charge density dynamics is mapped to what seems like a very different question. In ADS-CFT, the CFT is dual to, if it's a CFTD, dual to a D plus one dimensional anti-de-Sitter geometry with Einstein gravity. And in that setting, a question of what happens at finite charge density is mapped to the following. A U1 charge is represented in the bulk by a gauge field F, a Maxwell field. And the finite charge density means that you turn on a certain component of F that remains finite as you go to the boundary of ADS, a non-normalizable component that serves as a chemical potential. And then the entire question of what that finite density system does is determined by solving classical field equations that tell you, with that background for F, what happens in the deep interior of ADS in the region dual to low energy field theory, given that you turned on the charge density in the UV. Okay, so that's just a classical question in general relativity. The simplest theory that you could possibly consider would just have an Einstein gravity field and a Maxwell field. The Maxwell field has to be there to represent the U1 charge density. Okay. Now, what happens in the simplest examples is that Einstein-Maxwell theory does have interesting solutions if you turn on a finite charge density, which are exactly the ADS analogs of Reisner-Nordström black holes. Those are the black holes that would be like Schwarzschild in the real world, except if you managed to add some charge density that didn't instantly screen itself, which would happen in a real black hole. Okay, so the picture is there's some charge, it's somehow conserved, so there are flux lines coming out of the infrared and going to the UV. And you find the most general black hole solution with that value of the charge. The result is a line element that looks like this. Okay, if you're not familiar with relativity, don't worry, this painful part will be done soon. So little r is the holographic extra coordinate in ADS. F is 1 if this were to represent the anti-de-Sitter geometry itself. But F takes this complicated functional form as a function of the charge Q and the mass M of the black hole, and mu is the chemical potential. I think these solutions in ADS were first studied actually by Rob and Cliff Johnson and others in 1999. Is that right?
Solutions like that.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so this extremal geometry this geometry is kind of complicated. So there's this function F and there's a Q and an M and it's a little confusing. But it does something very interesting if you're interested only in zooming in on the part of the ADS space that's representing the dual field theory at very low energies. That limit is the deep infrared limit in field theory. It's the small r limit in the geometry. The smallest r that we can talk about comfortably is the r at the horizon of the black hole. And in the extremal limit, the limit where you take the charge to be as large as it can for a given mass, and the Hawking temperature goes to zero, so you're studying really a zero temperature state of matter, what you find is that the geometry drastically simplifies. Instead of the mess I showed you before, the spatial geometry just becomes dx squared plus dy squared, which we all know is our friend Minkowski space, well, R2. And the line element in the rest of the ADS becomes a metric on just ADS2. So the ADS4 black hole simplifies to an ADS2 times R2 geometry. And it became clear from work, especially of the group at MIT, but also work done here, that fermions in this kind of geometry, in this finite density geometry, actually manifest a very striking kind of non-Fermi liquid behavior due to their interaction with the large NCFT. Okay, so this can be understood directly in quantum field theory. And so I'll explain it to you that way, and you'll see why it inspired what comes later. Okay, so consider a field theory with the following action. We have our friend the fermion. Here I've called it C. So it has its standard kinetic term and chemical potential and some hopping. And we're coupling it to some mysterious strongly coupled field theory by the lowest dimension fermionic operator that we can possibly couple the fermion to, just power counting. You couple it in the most relevant way you can. So we'll call that coupling G, and we're just going to study what happens in perturbation theory in G with a large N hidden sector. Now, we're going to make an assumption. The assumption comes out of this striking result in holography. I'll drop this assumption in the main part of my talk, but this is what came out of holography. The assumption we'll make is that the structure of correlators in the infrared of this theory, well, of the strongly coupled sector at least, is actually the same structure of correlators that you'd get in a theory that had an emergent ADS2 geometry, okay, which is a very different symmetry group than you actually get in conventional quantum field theories. In terms of dynamical scaling, this corresponds to an emergent Z equals infinity dynamical scaling. Because in this metric for ADS2, you can see there's a symmetry where you rescale time in the radial direction, but not space. So that's like an infinite dynamical critical exponent. Now, in perturbation theory, in G in such a theory, what would you do? Well, here the fermion moves merrily along. And here it moves merrily along and then mixes with the operator OF that it's coupled to. And here it moves merrily along and mixes twice. And then you might imagine, since you don't know much about the strongly coupled sector, that there are all kinds of Feynman lines that come off here and attach here and make your life miserable. But at large n, that doesn't happen. At large n, all those diagrams are suppressed by 1 over n. And so this stupid geometric series is the exact answer for the self-energy. So the C fermion self-energy can be written in terms of a two-point function of O in the following way. The Baer propagator was omega minus vk. And the dressing up by this geometric series gives you a g squared times the Green's function of the operator O, which is evaluated in this weird theory that has z equals infinity scaling. Okay. So now, without knowing anything else about that theory, just from the scaling, the fact that it has z equals infinity, we know that the two-point function will be some function of omega. So it, without loss of generality, it's some constant times omega to the 2 delta minus 1, where delta is the conventional scaling dimension of O. And what that means is that if delta is less than 1, this power is less than omega. And that means that in this dressed up propagator, the correction term at low frequency dominates over the Baer kinetic term, and you get a non-Fermi liquid. Okay, and that's evident because the simple pole and therefore the spectral weight of the quasiparticle will disappear from the Green's function when delta is less than 1. When delta is equal to 1, you'll get something very interesting called marginal Fermi liquid behavior that I won't talk about more. Okay, so what this does do is give a controlled derivation of some kind of non-Fermi liquid behavior. But it does this in very peculiar theories. So there are lots of papers about this, but either from the perspective of having z equals infinity, which seems very strange and finely tuned, or if you're a real physicist, from the perspective of having to compute an Reisner-Nordström black hole geometry to study Fermi liquids, you should be suspicious that maybe the pictures you're getting here aren't really very likely to come out of more conventional field theories. Okay? And so what we decided to do is take some of this lesson that we should study Fermi liquids coupled to interesting bosonic theories, but we decided a much simpler interesting bosonic theory would be the single critical boson representing a second order phase transition at large n. Okay. So that's the end of what I was going to say about stringy things. Let's just go back to the field theory. So we're going to have to do some kind of renormalization group. What kind of RG are we going to do? Well, the different states in the decoupled high energy fixed points scale rather differently. The Fermi surface for the fermion means that low energy modes are in a little red ring around the surface, the black surface there. So the states in here are filled, the states out here are empty. And we decimate by shrinking the size of the red band around the Fermi surface. Okay. On the other hand, for the boson, the low energy modes, the UV fixed point, certainly live at zero momentum. And the RG that we're taught to do in any classical book on critical phenomena is you decimate by reducing Q spherically. Okay. And so we'll start by doing this kind of decimation. And then the most important scattering processes or couplings will be those that have a boson with some small momentum Q, some components parallel, some perpendicular to the Fermi surface, and they connect some fermion just inside to one just outside. So I'll do what I said before. I'm going to expand fermion momenta about the closest point on the Fermi surface. That means I choose some angle omega hat. So omega hat could point towards that point on the Fermi surface. And then I divide the momentum into a K Fermi that just puts me on the surface and an excitation amount L. And the scaling I'm going to do is what I said. KF doesn't scale. The transverse bit to the Fermi surface scales like e to the t, where t is the RG parameter. And so does k naught prime, the energy of the quasiparticle. Whereas for the boson, I'm just going to do what's indicated in this picture here. I'll scale isotropically. Okay, so this is an asymmetric treatment, but it's what you have to do if you're using the UV fixed points in perturbation theory. Now, what that implies for the scaling of the fields is that psi scales with dimension 3/2, and phi scales in this d-dependent way as d plus 3 over 2. With the scaling, this is the same scaling for the fermion that was used by Shankar and by Polchinski. So the BCS4 fermion interaction will remain marginal at tree level in all dimensions. Okay, that's good. The bosonic quartic coupling will scale in this way. And so d equals 3 is the upper critical dimension. And so if I do perturbation theory about d equals 3 in the epsilon expansion, I should expect to find interesting logs. Okay, and finally, we should then expand the Yukawa coupling around the Fermi surface. The most relevant piece is just G evaluated at the given angle at KF. And then there are higher derivative pieces that give irrelevant couplings in the low energy action. Okay, and we actually see that for the Yukawa, just like for the Quartic, the lowest momentum piece, this piece here, actually is exactly marginal also in D equals three dimensions. Okay, and so doing the epsilon expansion will work not just for lambda, but also for G. And so one can expect to find some kind of controlled behavior. Now, I'm going to note here, and this might be related to a question I was asked earlier, that there are different reasonable possible choices for Fermi surface scaling. There's something called patch scaling that I know Sung-Sik is a big fan of. And I'm not going to do that kind of scaling. I'll explain to you where it comes from a little later on. But I'm going to do exactly the scaling I said here. And I think the reasons that I'm doing this should be very clear. It's that starting from the UV fixed points, which are a free boson or a phi to the fourth boson, and a free Fermi liquid, that's what you do in perturbation theory. You scale like the decoupled fixed points do, and you see where you go. Okay. So the scaling I'm using does revert to the obvious scalings as you decouple fixed points. And it does maintain this obvious marginality of the most important four fermion interactions. But it is different from what lots of people do. So now, how should you think of the problem? It's nice to have some kind of dramatic tension when you're attacking a physics problem. So what is the dramatic tension in this problem? The dramatic tension is the following. You have two different sets of degrees of freedoms. There's the bosons, which would naturally be at a Wilson-Fisher fixed point in 3 minus epsilon dimensions. There's this whole Fermi surface of gapless fermions. And each one is trying to destroy the other. Okay. Once they interact, the bosons have this Landau damping diagram. It's the self-energy due to a loop of fermions at the Fermi surface. And that's roughly trying to destroy the bosons. It allows them to decay into fermions, at least virtually. But also, the bosons are dressing up the free Fermi liquid. And one very interesting possible outcome of that is that could give rise to a non-Fermi liquid. Okay. And of course, these two are coupled. If this becomes a non-Fermi liquid, this diagram changes and vice versa. Okay. So really, the tension in the literature on this subject has been who wins, the bosons or the fermions? Which effects are most important? So here's the mainstream philosophy, which means in the several thousand papers on this subject, the formulas that come out of this can be found in most of them. It's due to Hertz in 1976. And Hertz's main point of view was that this damping of the bosons due to the fermions is going to be the most important effect. Okay? The reason that Hertz actually focused on this diagram is what he was interested in doing is finding critical phenomena in the presence of a metal. Okay, critical phenomena with a Fermi surface. And so he wanted to integrate out the fermions, get an order parameter action, and study what the order parameter action says about the phase transition. The result was he integrated out the fermions at the Fermi surface. He found an action that in K space looks like this. So the boson keeps an omega squared and K squared at tree level. But the interaction at one loop generates a correction that goes like omega over K. Okay, and so actually at low energies, the omega over K from this term dominates over the omega squared here. And you get an emergent dynamical scaling for the boson that's roughly z equals 3 scaling. And that z equals 3 scaling has played a very important role in a lot of this literature. I should note that this is a dangerous procedure for just the obvious reason that you're integrating out gapless degrees of freedom. Okay, so maybe you can do it, maybe you can't, but it's dangerous. There are modern variants of Hertz's approach, but I think they all have in common the fact that you overdamp the bosons this way, from this diagram, then you feed that back into the fermion propagator and you find what you find. Okay. And so that it's a cogent philosophy, I just explained it to you, but I'm not going to do that here. Okay, so what I'm instead going to do is try to treat the bosons and fermions on completely equal footing. In particular, I'm not going to allow loop correction to dominate over the perturbative leading order contribution in the kinetic term. And I'm just going to evaluate Feynman diagrams or RG trajectories perturbatively. On the other hand, you want to be able to make some kind of statement. So to do that, I'm going to have to introduce parameters that simplify my life so I don't have to compute all diagrams. And those will be various large n or small epsilon ones. Okay, and what we're going to find is very unsurprising. This is one philosophy. It can happen, and it does happen somewhere. But where it happens is one extreme limit of a parameter space where, as you vary the number of bosons and the number of fermions, the large NF limit at fixed n gives what looks like the Hertz answer over a wide range of energies. The large NB limit at fixed NF gives a completely different non-Fermi liquid fixed point that I'll talk about. And in general, I think there's a trajectory out here at large NB and large NF, but but varying ratio, that I think should be mapped out and that I think will give a wide range of exponents that vary as you move along the trajectory. Okay, so I think this is where most analyses sit now, and we'll mostly talk about this, and really the interesting thing is to sweep out the whole space. Okay, so we're gonna now just do RG and the epsilon expansion. So we have couplings that are marginal in three dimensions, so we can hope to find controlled fixed points. You can use different decimation procedures when you do this, and because the theory isn't relativistic and the diagrammatics is very confusing compared to relativistic quantum field theory, I recommend that if you try to do this kind of procedure, you decimate in different ways and compare answers, because it's very easy to miss important physical effects that are scheme dependent. So we've considered two different kinds of decimation. One where we just integrate out modes by decimating an energy, and at each energy scale integrating over all k. And the other where we're actually decimating out radially in omega L space. Okay. And I think we find consistent answers the two ways. I'll mostly talk about this, but I think it's important to make sure that you account for possible scheme dependence. So the diagrams that arise at one loop are just these. Okay, this is the boson self-energy, this is an important guy. This is the fermion self-energy, this is the other most important guy. Then there are a bunch of loops that correct the quartic self-interaction, the Yukawa vertex, and the four Fermi interactions. Okay, but the two heroes for today will be diagrams A and D, and their generalization to large N, where we can sum up infinite sets that are like that. Okay, now there's an immediate and interesting result in the RG, which is as soon as you decimate, either this way or this way, it becomes trivial to evaluate the boson self-energy and the quartic renormalization, because actually in this decimation where you don't go down to zero energy, but just decimate over a finite energy regime, the boson self-energy pi actually vanishes. Okay, normally it would get contributions where these two things are on opposite sides of the Fermi surface. That never happens in a decimation. Okay, and what that means is that the diagram that normally yields the most dramatic effect in Hertz-Millis theory will not contribute in an RG where you decimate this way. Okay? That doesn't mean Landau damping isn't important and present. This is just a technical statement about the RG. So you can go check these diagrams. Now, I should note that if you computed a correlation function at some fixed point you find this way, in correlation functions, you don't cut off your integrals. You integrate all the way down to low energy. In such a correlator, you would pick up singularities that would be absent in this regulated diagram and that would give you, for instance, this kind of contribution. So the theory knows that it has to face Landau damping, but that doesn't show up in this RG trajectory. Okay, diagram C, which is the boson self, you know, vertex self-renormalization, is the standard computation that gives you the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. So you get a running of lambda phi that has a contribution from the bare dimension in 3 minus epsilon dimensions, and this quadratic thing with a positive constant from the standard Wilson-Fischer loop diagram. And then the fermion self-energy diagram gives some non-trivial wave function renormalization sigma, z for the fermion. So the self-energy has some log divergence in it, where A is, again, some positive constant we computed. The beta function for the Yukawa arises from both the fact that the fermion does have wave function renormalization and from an explicit vertex correction that, again, you can compute. It's actually related in some very simple way to the fermion self-energy diagram. And I think that's actually an important and deep fact. They're always related in this way. But anyway, so again, C3 is some constant that you can compute. It depends on N. So the resulting flow equation is dg dt has an epsilon over 2 from being in below the upper critical dimension. And then it has these bits that come from the vertex renormalization and sigma. Okay, and so there's a fixed point. The fixed point is where g is epsilon over 2 times 1 plus this constant. The constant is 1 in the theory of a single boson coupled to fermions, and it's n in the large, 1 over n in the large n theory. Okay, so I just summarized a bunch of one loop calculations. What do we learn? What we learn is that this most naive RG does give a fixed point, which is a modification of the standard fixed point. You get, at leading order, a Wilson-Fischer boson with lambda flowing to the same value at leading order in every expansion. But the fermion actually gets dressed into a non-Fermi liquid. The Yukawa coupling is stabilized at some finite value, and the fermion develops in an anomalous dimension. Okay, so this is roughly a Wilson-Fisher fixed point destroying a fermion into a non-Fermi liquid. At small epsilon, obviously, the expansions I discussed are controlled. The anomalous dimension you just compute, it's epsilon over 8 at this order. And so the Green's function takes the following form. It'll be omega minus vk to 1 minus 2 gamma, where gamma is the anomalous dimension. But it's important that because the symmetry of the problem is so small, there is an unknown function, f of omega over l, that could in principle appear in this Green's function. So you have to be careful in thinking about the pole structure. Okay? And this function you just have to compute order by order in perturbation theory. You don't have enough scaling symmetries to fix this. So even the two-point function is something rather painful to extract. And if you do it in different schemes, you'll find a term out front that looks different. And the differences are made up for by changes in the form of this scaling function. Okay, in particular, this is very clearly a different result from the standard approach. Because in Hertz-Millis theory, in epsilon, three minus epsilon dimensions, the lifetime of the fermion is given by omega to the 1 minus epsilon over 3. And here it's given by 1 minus epsilon over 4. Okay. So whatever this fixed point is, it isn't the thing that comes out of Hertz-Millis theory. Okay, now here's an aside, which is getting at part of Ite's question. I talked about renormalization of various things, but not the 4 Fermi coupling. There are a number of reasons for that. Okay, there are many interesting things that do happen with the 4 Fermi coupling. There are possible instabilities to superconductivity. And one of the really interesting things here is that in this RG, you actually find log squared running instead of log running of lambda. So you might get higher scale superconductivity than you're used to. But that makes the RG subtle here. And all these phenomena still happen at parametrically low energy scales compared to the E Fermi times an exponential that's small in a coupling. So I'll ignore this. There's another possible instability found by DGR and explained to me by Son after I gave this talk in Trieste of possible instabilities to chiral waves on the Fermi surface. That happens at an even lower scale than this. So I'll ignore that instability too. But what that means is I'm always working in this talk at energies that are far less than the UV scale, but above some exponentially small scale where a little dome might cover up the critical point. Okay, so I told you things in the epsilon expansion. They're all very standard. You know, if Cardi had felt like working them out 25 years ago, he could have done it in 5 minutes. So now we're going to try and go a little bit beyond the epsilon expansion. We need a tool. We can't just magically guess what happens. So we're going to invoke large N. Okay, and there are different ways to do this, and I'll just discuss them both briefly. The first way, which will be more different than what's normally done in this literature, is taking N to infinity with NF fixed. So that's a large matrix interacting with a fixed number of flavors of fermions. So in this limit, we're going to consider the following theory. Okay, the N scalings here are fixed so that the couplings remain, they don't grow in importance in the large N expansion. And the important point here is that with the matrix boson, there are two different possible interactions that go like phi to the fourth. One is trace phi to the fourth, where phi is an N by N matrix. The other is trace phi squared squared. These two are really quite different. Okay, this interaction, if present, makes this theory about as hard to solve as non-abelian gauge theory. And in gauge theories, this kind of interaction is sort of obligatory. It's always there. This thing is actually quite harmless. If you have this interaction, then what I've written is basically a vector-like large N theory with N squared fields in the boson instead of N, okay, because of this trace phi squared squared structure. And so this sector will be soluble. And then there's an interaction between the matrix field and the fermions. So what I'm going to do, given what I just told you, is set lambda phi 1 to 0. And that's radiatively stable. It's allowed by symmetry, which is only broken softly by the Yukawa coupling. So if we do that, we set lambda phi 1 to 0, we can solve this theory at large N. Okay, now in this theory, this large N theory, the only contribution to the 4 Fermi beta function comes from the wave function renormalization of the fermion. All the subtleties I mentioned on the slide with skeletons are 1 over N artifacts. And so you actually find an RG equation for the 4 Fermi interaction that looks like this. And so the result is that if you take the Yukawa to be the simplest possible thing at constant over the Fermi surface, you get a Wilson-Fisher boson that dresses the fermion into a non-Fermi liquid and that is actually stable against superconductivity. This causes weak attractive interactions to flow to 0. Now, what happens in the Green's functions? Okay, I guess you probably can't see those diagrams, right? So let me draw it over here. The interesting thing will be what happens to sigma, and it gets contributions from all rainbow diagrams at large n. Okay, the rainbow diagrams are things that look like this with no crossing of the bosonic lines. And so you need to be able to sum up those rainbow diagrams. We think we can do it. It's a little subtle. You have to write an integral equation that relates sigma to some loop integral that has a sigma in it, and then try to solve the integral equation. But we think we've done it. And we think the result that comes out is that the Green's function is omega to the 1/2 times this scaling function that you have to compute order by order. But very clearly, in this large n limit, the graphs that look like this are 1 over n suppressed compared to the fermion self-energies. So in that dramatic battle between bosons and fermions, in this limit, the bosons win. The fermion is dressed into a non-Fermi liquid. Now, the first 1 over n correction will definitely reintroduce Landau damping, and you'll get into this hell of non-local kinetic terms. But it's important that because the first 1 over n correction is evaluated with the leading n propagator for the fermion, the form of Landau damping, and hence the form of the boson self-energy, will be different than it is in Hertz-Mills theory. Okay, so this is a theory that would have Landau damping, and so there are non-trivial effects of both sectors on one another, but it doesn't give you the Z equals 3 boson. This also means that everything I told you becomes a lie at a low energy scale. Okay, if you look at the scale where this peculiar-looking renormalized boson self-energy becomes comparable to the leading order tree level piece, that tells you that there's some low energy scale G squared over N times E Fermi where everything I've told you is probably wrong. So what I'm telling you, I'm pretty confident it's true, but it's true over a range of energies that goes from E Fermi to something like G over N E Fermi. And then down here, I honestly have no idea what happens. Okay, so at large n, I've told you a wide range of things, and at small n and small g, I've told you a little bit, and when g and n are both of order 1, I haven't told you anything. But that's how it is with controlled expansions.
So what is the scale of t squared over n? What I'm trying to say is that whether there's some kind of a bandwidth, you know, there's something used to be gapless, I mean, zero energy, entropy, and somehow due to long run correction, they open up a little bit of band, which bandwidth have to be t squared over n.
You want to say the bosons have some kind of bandwidth?
Usually what happens is, you may have some degree of freedom with zero energy.
Yeah.
And that may decohere some fermion causing this. And so I try to understand whether in your theory can we identify this zero energy degree of freedom, which eventually open up a gap, which is open up the bandwidth, which is T squared over N, then we can understand what's going on. Or whether this is not very clear.
So to me, it's not very clear. I'll only say the following. Again, we're always doing the most naive thing. So if you stare at the Feynman integrals that come out of these kinds of expansions, what's always true is that, what is the reason that people like the Hertz-Millis scaling? It's that if you actually stare at the self-energy diagrams, you can actually see that parts of the diagram are dominated by an energy and momentum region in the diagram that has omega going like k cubed. Okay, and so that's the sense in which people are very tempted to say, oh, there's an effective boson with omega goes like k cubed. Okay, and what's true in these theories is, as you vary n, if you just stare at the diagrams, there are regions dominated by the tree level scaling, and there are also kinematic regions dominated by weird behaviors like this. And so if I was very naive, I would say, oh, what happens is there's a new quasi-particle with this kind of dispersion in this very low energy regime. Now, my history learned from studies of things like QCD is that that's a very bad thing to do. You have to be really careful about saying there's an emergent new degree of freedom because it appears in some region in some Feynman diagram, right? So I wouldn't want to do that, but if I tried to answer your question naively, what I would do is I'd stare at regions in the integrals dominated by this kind of scaling and say there's a new emergent degree of freedom with that weird scaling. Was that too long an answer or did it?
Yeah, that's fine. My understanding is that for the ADF CFP is that you have a black hole entropy, and that's how zero bandwidth. And then one way correction gives some bandwidth, and that's making you something.
No good. But
in this calculation, I wonder whether you can identify something.
Well, but this, I think this calculation is in a theory that is in many ways, well, better and worse are judgmental statements, but anyway, I'll be subjective. This theory is much better in the following sense. It doesn't have an emergent Z equals infinity, and it doesn't have ground state entropy at leading order in large n. And so I think a lot of the things that I don't trust in the ADS2 calculation, I trust here. There are still, of course, lots of things I don't trust here, too. But I'm at least telling you where I stop trusting.
I believe. they don't have black hole.
Yeah. The theory has a unique ground state. Okay. Yeah.
So how sensitive is this to solving this integral equation you mentioned? I think you resum all these Ringwood diagrams.
It's very sensitive. I mean, what's definitely true is in this opposite large n limit, it's obvious that the bosonic diagrams win, right? So you're going to dress the fermion into a non-Fermi liquid. The details of how that dressing happens, you have to solve the integral equation. But the big picture, which is as you interpolate to large bosonic n instead of large fermionic n, you first dress the fermion into a non-Fermi liquid, and then Landau damping is changed. That's a qualitative fact. And that, I think, will always be true as you add parameters to these theories. There will be some regions where Hertz-Mellis is the right procedure, especially at large NF with fixed other parameters. And there will be other regions, just as natural, some other thing is large, where the fermion is first dressed into a non-Fermi liquid, and so Landau damping changes. And so that's the takeaway lesson. This is the result of having very smart collaborators who work much harder than I do. Okay, so.
Why is it big? Big is not scale T square over 1. Is compared to what? Compared to omega or compared to omega?
No, that should be G squared over N times E Fermi.
Times E Fermi. What that comes to is if you compare this to omega, it seems that you need exponentially small omega for this term to be much bigger than omega. This itself, this pi, what do you compare pi with?
You compare pi to omega.
That looks like only exponential small energy have trouble.
Let's talk about it later. I'm trying to be as conservative as I can, and we could talk about all possible things that can happen that are horrible. Okay. Now let me discuss the other limit. I'll be shorter because this is the limit that's standard in the literature. It's NF to infinity with N fixed and usually 1. The resulting physics is very different. Okay, you can kind of see these diagrams. These are the obvious, they're basically RPA bubbles or something like them. These are just bubbles of the fermion renormalizing the boson self-energy. You sum over all the bubbles. At strictly NF goes to infinity, Hertz's theory is exact. The 1 over N expansion around that point is disastrously badly behaved at very low energy. That was explained by Sungsik. But it's still valid over some finite energy range down to the deep infrared at large NF. Okay? And so in that sense, Hertz's theory is exact or valid down to very low energies. You get a Z equals 3 boson. The fermion is dressed into a non-Fermi liquid, and this is the famous Z equals 3/2 non-Fermi liquid that you get out of Hertz-Mellis theory. Okay? And that's valid, again, down to some energy scales that go like E Fermi divided by NF. Now, the moral of the story, as far as I'm concerned, isn't that one of these is better than the other. It's that, obviously, there's a zoo of possible non-Fermi liquids. We looked at two very extreme examples. And there are several distinct asymptotic limits that just have different behavior. So instead of really trying to argue about which limit to take, I think you should take all possible limits and study all the possible behaviors. That's what we did with QCD. Now, what's really interesting for us to ponder is this Veneziano limit, where we go out to large n, but with some fixed ratio of n over nf that we then vary between 0 and infinity. And we try to classify all those fixed points out at large n, where we still have a parameter. The overall moral that I've seen by playing with this for several months is that as you leave the extreme limit of small parameters, there are awful complicated problems to face in every possible limit. On the other hand, I have really strong young collaborators who can be sacrificed to fight the various terrible things that happen. So we're studying the 1 over NB expansion about NB equals infinity, the 1 over NF expansion about NF equals infinity, and the epsilon expansion. And hopefully by using these three parameters and sacrificing enough young people, we can make some progress. So thank you.
Dominance of rainbow diagram also happens in polaron problem when you have coupling of
phonons to
acoustic. So there it talks about some self-trapping of electron in the Bose field. So is it suggesting something similar, that is breakup of Fermi surface? And
well, another wise person said this analogy to me, Steve Kibbleson. Maybe it is. The phonon you mean is not derivatively coupled. It's coupled by a straight Yukawa, or it's derivatively coupled?
Yukawa, yeah.
If it's coupled by Yukawa, then the problems are mathematically very similar. So I would guess that what you would find would be very similar. And this could be some kind of large N treatment of a polaron problem.
In the context of high energy physics, it's also called Tam-Dankov approximation. The early, again, rainbow diagrams dominates,
right,
and then there's some kind of self-trapping.
But what do you mean precisely by self-trapping?
So if we look at the effective mass of the particle,
yeah,
as a function of coupling constant, it undergoes some discontinuous change.
Oh, you mean it jumps because of the dressing by the gas of electrons?
Exactly, yes. Some
no, good. I think that's very similar to the dressing of the boson by these fermion loops. I mean, here, again, what it's thought to do is this in all kinds of papers in the literature that we could talk about. So I'm not sure if that's the same outcome, but it's thought to give this Z equals 3 emergent boson scaling instead of generating large boson mass.
There, the difference there, you are considering one particle coupled to Bose field. Here you have a Fermi C. But since all kinds of momentum transfer is allowed, maybe it's, yeah, there's some connection, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Whatever, yeah.
So your theory is this energy scale g squared over n EF below which you can go, it's only for the case of large boson flavor, right?
Well, no, at large fermion flavor, some more terrible thing happens, in my opinion. So what I would say is that, what's usually done in most of the treatments in the literature, the words vary, but what's actually done is the same. And what's actually done is you compute the one loop correction. You then declare that if you're interested in very low energies, normally this is approximated as omega over k. You throw out the omega squared kinetic term, and you re-expand the theory about an action where the boson has an omega over k instead of an omega squared, and the k squared spatial momenta. That changes the scaling. So what you're doing, whatever it is not perturbation theory about decoupled bosons and fermions. It's something else. But if you do that, then you'll have this Z equals 3 boson, and you'll get this result, and you might want to trust it. What I would say, being somebody who does perturbation theory, okay, is that as soon as you see this, what it tells you isn't that you should re-expand the action. It's telling you that at a certain low energy scale, the loop expansion associated with this action is no longer consistent, because the one loop correction is dominating over the tree level scaling. What that usually means to me is that you don't know what you're doing. Okay, so as somebody who just does perturbation theory with no physical intuition at all, I would say this is good exactly down to the energies where g squared omega over k goes like omega squared, and then you're dead. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, but that's the standard approach, right? It's independent of the number of boson flavors.
Yeah, but it depends on the number of fermion flavors, yeah. Because there's an NF here. So it would be very similar. The approach would get better and better as NF goes to infinity.
I think there are two scales below which you can't go. So one has to do with this.
One has to do with NF and one has to do with NB in the two opposite regimes. Yeah.
Yeah, the really question is that, I forgot, do you have a boson velocity? Whether the boson velocity is bigger than Fermi velocity or smaller or the same here? What do you choose?
Yeah, what I was talking about here is mostly the case where C equals V.
Oh, I see.
And I agree that if you take very extreme limits, for instance, in the limit that C is extremely large compared to V,
yeah.
Very little phase space of boson plays any role in the problem. That's one extreme limit. In the other extreme limit, other things can happen.
Yeah, less, yeah.
So I was really assuming they're of the same order. And I agree that can make.
But at least would change your physics somehow. The thing is that if C is much bigger than VF, then there's no damping at the moment.
Absolutely.
The whole thing may be changed.
Absolutely.
Much less than you have another
scale. Absolutely. So here I was assuming that they're the same order. And something that we're doing now is actually studying rather carefully what happens as a function of C over V. Because there are really three parameters, C, V, and G.
Okay.
And so there are two dimensionless ratios. And life with one dimensionless ratio is hard enough. So with two, you know, you need even more grad students. But anyway. Yeah.
This is a very naive question because maybe I'm thinking about the Fermi's surface as well. But in general, when you have that Fermi coupling of the scalar, as you go down the low energy, depending on the ratio of the Yokawa to your quartic, you can generate a condensation in the scalars, right? You'll drive the mass of the scalar negative. And that will take you into a new phase of the theory altogether.
Yeah, no, so here, I understand your question perfectly, but here what I'm doing, and I don't know how to move this fast. Okay, we'll forget this. Here what I'm doing is assuming, okay, in condensed matter, unlike in parts of the high energy community, fine tuning is totally accepted. Because what you fine tune in high energy is what the experimentalist does to see anything interesting in condensed matter. Okay, so roughly what I'm saying is we see the pizza wedge. I'm assuming that you sit at the tuned point where the pizza wedge comes out. I'm not going to worry about how you tune the UV Lagrangian to get to the pizza wedge. Does that answer your question? Yeah, okay.